I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
In faith, my lord, you are too willful blame. And since your coming hither, have done enough to put him quite besides his patience. You must needs learn, lord, to amend this fault. Though sometimes it show greatness, courage, blood, and that's the dearest grace it renders you, yet oftentimes it doth present harsh rage, defective manners, want of government, pride, haughtiness, opinion, and disdain, the least of which haunting a noble man, loseth men's hearts and leaves behind a stain upon the beauty of all parts besides, beguiling them of commendation.
Well, I'm schooled. Good manners be your speed.
Hello and welcome to The Play's the Thing. That was the Earl of Worcester speaking to Hotspur in Shakespeare's play Henry IV, Part 1. You have joined us for Act 3, and you have joined me. My name is Tim McIntosh.
And I'm Heidi White.
I'm Brandon LaPaul.
And we're so glad that you are part of this 6-part podcast series on Shakespeare's history play, Henry IV, Part 1. You guys, welcome back. Today is going to be a little bit of a toss back to Act 2, because Brandon said something really interesting, kind of comparing the relationship between two insurrectionists in this play and in a play, Julius Caesar, their relationships with their wives. I thought that was a really interesting comparison, and I want to go back to that. But I just want to kind of like set the table for what was going to happen in Act 3 of this play. So the big picture is this is a history play, and it's an insurrectionist history play, very similar to Richard II, very similar to Richard III, very similar to so many of Shakespeare's plays. If he's obsessed about one thing, is Shakespeare, he's probably more obsessed about kingly power and the threat of an uneasy transfer of power than he is about really anything else in the world. And this is another occasion, Henry IV, in which he kind of delves into that subject. So early in this act, Act 3, Scene 1, there's a meeting in Wales, and there are all these conspirators that are talking, Mortimer, Glendower, Hotspur, Worcester, and they're already kind of planning on how they're going to divide up their territory once they take over the kingdom. The big threat to the kingdom, of course, is not just these insurrectionists, but it's the kind of failure of young Hal, of Prince Harry, to kind of step into the mantle of being the king. So Act 3, Scene 2 is King Henry's frustration with Harry about his conduct and his choice of friends. And then in Scene 3, there are only three scenes in this play. We're back at the tavern, and Harry is being Harry, and he's joking around with Falstaff and talking about money, and Falstaff is being his big, funny, insouciant self, kind of right when we need Hal to step up. But before we get to that, I want to go back, Brandon, to something you mentioned at the end of Act Two. I'd like to hear you compare these two insurrectionists from these two plays. So Hotspur from this play and Brutus from Julius Caesar. Hotspur's wife, Kate, and Brutus's wife, Portia, each suspect their husband's insurrection plot. I would love to hear you talk about this, Brandon. Hotspur's response to Kate when confronted is pretty different than Brutus's response to his wife, Portia. Can we glean anything about Hotspur and Brutus's character based on their responses to their wives?
Yeah, I think the circumstances and the scenes are so similar, and yet the differences are really what set the two apart, the two characters. You have two men who both have expressed this perceived threat of tyranny, right? There's for Hotspur, it's that Henry IV is becoming a tyrant. He's not doing what he's supposed to as the king, as far as the prisoners that were taken, we talked about in Act One. And then with Brutus, you know, this clearly is Caesar trying to move from being consul to being emperor, essentially, right? And in a way that's not in accordance with the Republic.
Yeah.
But then you have a younger man and an older man and a younger wife and an older wife. And I think a lot of that is where they start to diverge. First of all, you with Hotspur, he's decided at this, by the time he's talking to his wife, that Henry is a tyrant and has to be dealt with. Mm. Right. And when Portia approaches Brutus, it's because he's wrestling. He's wrestling with what to do. He is, challenging those who would say that they should assassinate Caesar, and questioning them right before that scene, and then continue to wrestle with it. And then like you mentioned, the way they respond verbally to their wives is so incredibly different, right? Hotspur mocks Kate. He denounces her. He says, "I can totally trust you as far as you're a woman." Like, he points out her womanly weakness in being able to keep any secrets of his. Whereas Brutus acknowledges Portia's concern. He accepts her, the credentials she offers him, which I'll talk about in a second. Calls in her an honorable wife, where, like I said, Hotspur denounces her, denounces Kate. And then ultimately Brutus acquiesces to tell her, but then gets interrupted. And so he only doesn't tell Portia, or at least we don't know that he tells her in the text of the play, because someone interrupts before they're able to get to that. And Kate, for her part, she doesn't approach the same way Portia does, right? She comes in attacking. It's funny that both women start out with, like, "Why aren't you in our marriage bed? This is a problem. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to be, there's something amiss here." Almost this denial of the marriage rights. But with Kate, it's a threat almost immediately. She threatens to break his finger. She demands to know. She makes guesses and warns him against things she's just guessing, that she's speculating on. She's right for the most part, but she doesn't approach him in a way that helps any. Whereas Portia supplicates and she gives her credentials. And she even acknowledges the fact that, "I understand I'm a woman and you might not be able to, you might think you can't trust me, but I'm such a woman as Brutus would marry, and the daughter of Cato, not the standard fare, if you will." And that moves Brutus, you know, and he's somewhat shamed for not honoring his wife as he should have. And interestingly, she mentioned that when she tried to approach him the day before and he kind of waves her off, she takes his dismissal and doesn't push it, but now she's concerned for him. And so I think you have, two men who maybe could have avoided the tragedy they come to with the counsel of their wives. Kate certainly is telling him this is a bad idea to go throw in league with her brother and challenge the king. And then I think, you know, there's less obvious indication in the text what Portia would have counseled, though she seems to be to err on the side of caution in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so they could have avoided the tragedy. In Brutus's case, we find him more tragic because it's interrupted, and because we see him wrestling, he seems more, this is hard for him to decide what to do, to kill a king, right? Or to kill a leader in his case. And so we don't have that same kind of sympathy, I don't think, for Hotspur, because he doesn't do that wrestling. He gets offended and he burst out in action. And once that starts happening, he won't hear anybody, including his wife.
Yeah.
Where Brutus, we have a lot more sympathy for. And that may be a difference in their age and in their experience and in their wisdom. But
do we know what the age difference is between Hotspur and Brutus?
Maybe I'm biased by how I've seen the actors I've seen play the two parts.
Right.
Sure.
No, I've seen them. Hotspur tends to be cast young. Brutus tends to be cast older.
Brutus has a decently aged son. Like he's a child still, but he's, 8, 9, 10, 11, maybe his son, mm-hmm. I think. And mm-hmm. then Hotspur and Kate seem to have no children yet. And his father's still around, right? Like his father's still the Lord, Hotspur's is. Whereas Brutus appears to be the senior male in the family, and has been a senator for a while. So,
yeah, it's interesting to me that Kate comes bearing like threats of physical harm and Portia arrives having done herself physical harm. Right.
Yeah. It's an interesting
Portia having, she's cut her thigh and she kind of shows it. She uses it to demonstrate her fealty to Brutus. It also seems, now we're talking more about Kate and Portia than Hotspur and Brutus, but I don't know. I kind of see each of the wives as kind of reflections of the best and worst parts of their husbands, if that's fair or not.
Well, Portia even points out, you married a woman who's the daughter of Cato, who's a woman of the strength of you, Brutus, right? So that,
yeah,
by comparison, she seems as hot-headed as he is. Kate seems as hot-headed as Hotspur, but in it for her own reasons. Mm-hmm. There doesn't seem to be much temperance for either one of them in that scene.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a really interesting comparison. A really interesting comparison. Okay. Shifting our gaze back to Act 3 of Henry IV. Heidi, I'm going to ask you about Scene 1. Scene 1, for those kind of uninitiated into the history plays, might be kind of confusing. It's a long scene. It's a long argument. And a lot of the arguments, for me, they slipped right by me. I'm like, why all of this cantankerous words, why such an emphasis on Wales and England? I wonder, I honestly just like, aside from the aspect of who is going to get, about whether the territory is being divided up fairly, which is Hotspur's contention. He feels like his portion is not large enough. Aside from that, there seems to be lots of conflict, especially between Glendower and Hotspur. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can shed some light on this. It feels like we've walked into a family drama at midpoint, and we don't quite know what the family is actually arguing about. Help us, Heidi.
I like that setup a lot for the question, because I think what we have is one of Shakespeare's most useful tools for getting into the history play is exactly what you just said. It's a kind of a constant comparison and contrast between the personal and the political, right? So you have an immersion into a family conflict because Hotspur's in the play, Mortimer is I think introduced as his cousin, but in real life it was his brother-in-law. So there's a little bit of differences there, but that doesn't matter too much. And then there's a family connection also with Glendower. So there is this sense of a family drama where we're welcomed, so to speak, around the table of a personal conflict, a personality conflict, as we see between Glendower and Hotspur. But also zooming out, there's a political conflict. There's something at stake for on the national level and the imperial level going on within this scene. And that goes back even to the question that you brought up with Brandon, the conversation that the two of you just had about these marriages. Shakespeare loves doubles. He loves comparing and contrasting two things and embedding that comparison within the structure of a play. And Henry IV, Part One, I think, out of all of his plays, does it the best, although every play has it. And so here we have the political and the personal, the family conflict and the personality conflict, versus, and also the political and national and military conflict. And one feeds the other back and forth within this scene. So we have Hotspur is being brought to the table as kind of the darling or the apple of the rebel's eye, right? He is the young knight with a bright future, and everybody thinks well of him, and he has this honorable reputation, to the point that in another scene in this act, King Henry IV unfavorably compares his own son, Prince Hal, saying, I wish you were more like Hotspur. I wish mm-hmm. you were more like Percy, mm-hmm. right? So Percy's like the darling, the apple of England's eye. And so he's being brought to the table for counsel, and he can't stop picking a fight with the senior guy, right? Yeah. Glendower he's the boss, and Glendower has this, you know, every statement he makes, Hotspur's at him, just like picking a fight with him and undermining him on both the personal and the military level. He questions every decision he makes, and he's just picking at him personally and criticizing him publicly. And that gives us, I think, a lot of insight into Hotspur's character on the personal level. And then also it's yet another kind of prick in his reputation for those of us who are watching or reading, who have been told what an honorable knight he is. And yet on stage, he's picking a fight with his elders. He's picking fights with his wife. He's acting like a Hotspur, right? Which is mm-hmm. named after. He's acting hot-headed and unable to control his anger. And as we learn, that becomes his downfall. But his reputation, what is in conflict with what seems, right? And that is another double within the play. And then the other thing that we have in this scene is just a really interesting kind of national look at Wales and England, which I think mirrors the internal conflict of the play. Again, it's another double. On the political spectrum, we have, and it's particularly poignant, I think, within the marriage of Mortimer with his Welsh wife, and Glendower is his father-in-law. Mm-hmm. And so we have this really interesting another marriage doubling. You pointed out the Portia connection here, even within the play, in the internal landscape of the play. Harry Percy can't get along with his own wife, even in saying goodbye, and they might never see each other again, and they're still fighting with each other, versus Mortimer and his Welsh wife, and they can't even communicate with each other. They don't speak the same language, and yet they have this tenderness and this love between them as representative of each culture. And so there's this failure to communicate within the culture, and when Hotspur's around, it makes it worse. But when with this married couple, it's better, it's sweet, right? And so if I were teaching this play, this is where I would emphasize. What in this scene, where do you see kind of mirrors of each other, doubles of things, and how can we have create a conversation about those kinds of doubles? And they get complicated, but that's okay. It's really interesting to delve into this with students, and I think in as observers of the play.
Heidi, off the air, you mentioned another double. And this double is almost like an inverted doubling between King Henry and Falstaff. Can you tell us anything more about what you see there, this kind of inverted doubling?
Yeah. So if the question is, can I tell you anything about it? It's more going to be, can you stop me talking about it?
When to turn the fast faucet off?
How long are you going to talk about it? It's a very, very rich and complex doubling. I want to hear what Brandon has to say, and I'd like to maybe have a bit of a conversation back and forth about it with the three of us. But just to start us off, what we see in this play is Falstaff and Henry IV they're both father figures to Prince Hal, warring or vying for Prince Hal's loyalty and for Hal's kind of submission to their range of values, to what it is that they want him to be, right? So in Act 2, we saw that in sharp relief with Falstaff at the tavern. Again, the place, the setting in this play are doubles, right? You have the tavern versus the throne room, like the, mm-hmm. the hall of feasting, the hall of the place of drunkenness and debauchery versus the place of like pomp and circumstance and state governed by these like dutiful kind of rules, right? So chaos and order contrasted with each other, desire and duty contrasted with each other in a place. And if you notice in this play, Henry the Fourth and Falstaff are never on stage at the same time ever, which is brilliant on Shakespeare's part because it shows them as these competing father figures, each of them representing these competing forces in Hal's psyche, right? Mm. So we saw this with Falstaff when he says, pick me, right? This is what the play within the play in Act Two was in the tavern scene when he says, I'll act like the king and I'll tell you what I think is Falstaff. And then I want you to defend Falstaff to me, right? And it's this really, really complex kind of circles of identity taking place. And that scene, we already talked about that on the podcast. In this act, in scene two, Act Three, scene two, we have Henry just berating his son for his failures to live up to his expectations, comparing him to Percy, who we've just seen act like a jerk, right? But that's not what father sees. What daddy sees is this young man, Percy, who's acting better than Hotspur's better than you. Why don't you act more like him? Why don't you fall in line with what I want you to be? And the thing that so he proposes a really interesting idea to his son, which is always do your duty, never ever show your feelings or be who you really are in public, and act like I do, right? Fall in line, jettison any kind of life of desire, of personhood, and become just like me, become a mirror of me, right? And as we already know from the play in Henry V, in the last part of this tetralogy, Prince Hal is going to become not the mirror of his father or of Falstaff, but the mirror of all Christian kings. Mm. But both Falstaff and Henry in this play want him to become their own mirror, right? And so that is just creates this constant sense of disequilibrium within our main character, within Prince Hal. And it's really interesting the way he responds to that. So mm-hmm. I don't know, Brandon, do you want to add anything to that or any comments? Or
I just think even where right here, where we're talking about, you see this beginning of the rejection of that mirroring they want him to do, right? And as you were talking, I couldn't put my finger on it, but as you were talking, it kind of came to me. He's called upon and does, or starts to in this moment, clean up both of his father figure's messes, right? You have the father who's the king who's a usurper, and that's problematic. And we know, we've talked a little bit about that already, like how he's wrestling with inheriting from a usurper, right? But also the king's paranoia in the first act pushed Percy to react, right? His paranoia at the mention of Mortimer. And then you have this other father figure who got caught in his thieving and is, when we left the last act, was hoping that Hal could get him out of jail. And he does keep him out of, we find out in this act, keep him out of that trouble, but also puts him in command of a company of men. Like, you're going to have to go fight now. And so there's this interesting, he starts having to be the mature one, or to do the things to fix the problems those two men create, even right here in this act, right? And like you talked about, the fullness of that, isn't revealed until Henry V, but it begins here as he starts his turn in the middle of this first play.
You guys, is this, I think when I started reading this play, kind of knowing it was about the maturation of Hal, I thought that we might get from Shakespeare kind of a story of the duties required to be king and kind of a growth into the enlightenment of Hal, recognizing the duties that he needs to take on in order to inherit the throne and be a good king. I wonder if it's more of that, or Heidi, Do you think this is more of a story about the desire for a son to be connected to his father or to a father?
It's both. It's both. That's what makes this play so rich. It's both it's about the education of a king. And that's what the whole tetralogy is, right? It is what Shakespeare's asking the question, what kind of man is a good king? And he gives us in all of his history plays, specifically his English history plays, these kings as central figures and their failures and their foibles and their glories. And he just hands them to us like, look at this, mm-hmm. look at this, Richard VI, who was a good man, but a bad king, mm-hmm. right? Richard II, who was we've already talked about that.
A great poet, but a bad king. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Is it like, what does it take to be a good king? And in Prince Hal, we have the mirror of all Christian kings. And yet right now in this play, we have a dissolute young prodigal like carousing around London with a fat knight, right? How in the world is he going to go from that to becoming the mirror of all Christian kings? And so what Shakespeare does in this fictionalized version of a real man's life is he's like, what if, look at all of these competing forces that are fighting for this man's soul and his position. And how is he going to resolve that? Like, he is not afraid to put Hal in impossible situations. This is an impossible situation, both politically and personally, for a young man rejected by his father, who is ashamed of him, who's a usurper in an era of history who believed that the sins of the father would be inherited by the son. And also at a time that believed in the divine right of kings. This is impossible for Hal to become the mirror of all Christian kings. He can't, according to the cultural and political guidelines of the day, according to the belief system of the day. Plus, he's in this political situation of being being attacked by rebel forces, right? In which some people would look at that and say that's justice because his father was a usurper. And that is just like a very, like those kind of outside and external forces, plus the internal force of psychologically what it means to be a man, to be rejected by a cold-hearted, distant father who was not a good man, right? And then to be embraced by this life of desire led by Falstaff. It is the classic Duty and Desire story for this battling for the soul in the position of a young man. It's why it's such a psychological drama and also political drama. It's just perfect. It's like nearly perfect. And so we do have this constant competition between the father of duty and the father of desire for the soul of this young man, who also then has a double of his own in Percy, who does embody all of the proposed social virtues, right? He's a sense of Vronsky, right? Mm-hmm. He has, as we've been talking about over on the Patreon podcast about Anna Karenina, Vronsky is this like empty souled person, but he has this veneer of social polish, which makes him look like the perfect man, but inside he's vacant and empty. And we have that in Hotspur as well, as this kind of double to everybody thinks well of Percy and yet he's empty on the inside. On the other hand, you have Prince Hal and nobody thinks well of Prince Hal, but he has all of the ability and the capacity and the potential and the drivenness toward on the inside. We already know he is planning to cast aside his image and identity as a prodigal and fully own himself as a king. In fact, he's two steps ahead of his father, because his father gives him the advice here in Act 3, Scene 2, tells him, go ahead and go and don't show yourself too much to the people, kind of hide in the background. And then, because if you show yourself too much, it's like the sweetness of honey. And then the people get sick of you and they don't want you anymore. So he gives him this advice. He's telling him, don't go out and be among the people. Don't hang out with Falstaff anymore, because then the people are just going to think you're a common man. You have to be more like me and be aloof and cultivate your image. So use politics as theater, right?
Yeah.
Falstaff told him to use politics as to advance Falstaff, right? And he's so Falstaff essentially says the same thing. Let's use politics as theater. And then the king says the same thing. Let's use politics as theater. But Prince Hal's way ahead of both of them, because in Act One, Scene Two, he says that he gives his famous soliloquy when he says, when this loose behavior I throw off and pay the debt I never promised, by how much better than my word I am, by so much shall I falsify men's hopes. And like bright metal on a sullen ground, my reformation, glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes than that which hath no foil to set it off. He essentially does exactly, he's way ahead of both Falstaff and his father, but none of them have enough faith in him to believe that he's capable of that.
Mm.
Interesting.
That's beautiful. Those are beautiful lines that you found, Brandon.
Yeah, that's interesting to say he's way ahead of them. I think that the evidence is there in the text. And then at the same time, I think there's a real desire to be seen well in his actual father's eyes. And so there's a sense in which that striving to be honored by his father, to be worthy of his father's honor, is what starts to shift him into the mindset of what it requires to be king, what's required of that person, right? And we get that in Act 3, Scene 2, in his response. And he says, I will redeem all this on Percy's head, and in the closing of some glorious day, be bold to tell you that I am your son, when I will wear a garment all of blood and stain my favors in a bloody mask, which washed away shall scour my shame with it. And so he knows that he has to go. Well, and he goes on to say that this will happen when he meets Hotspur, not when their armies meet, when he meets Hotspur. Right. And so there's this accepting of there's something I have to do to prove my own mettle. And that's more intimate than just commanding your troops. But then he does go on to begin that. And then he enlists Falstaff in his saving of him. He puts him in charge of something, and his words to him are, the land is burning, Percy stands on high, and either we or they must lower lie. And so he knows he has to risk and sacrifice to be the king, it is very much he needs to prove himself to his father, but in the doing of that he begins to accept what's required of being king. And it's a sacrifice of self. It's a reduction of self in the pleasures and the desires. And one doesn't go without the other in this work. So.
Right. Well, and to your point, Brandon, I'm so glad you said that, because Hal is tormented. He's not just a king. He's not just a prince who's going to become a king. He's not just the Prince of Wales. Like, he's a man. He's not a boy, but he's a young man who's has these father figures that are both seeking to use him to advance what they want. Right. And you can see in him, there's like robust humanity and this depth of emotion, as well as a knowledge and an ownership of his own position. And so psychologically, it makes sense that he does become a prodigal. Like, I don't buy that it's all strategic. I also think it's human. I also think it's a longing of this young man who knows he has to sublimate his humanity to his position from a father who earned it by deposition, or excuse me, who stole it, and also a father who has rejected him. To me, it makes perfect sense on a human level. I really don't buy that it's just strategic. I think he's nurturing a need by going out and getting drunk with Falstaff. It's a very human response. Like, if I have to give up my whole life for this duty that so far this man, my father, has just rejected me and berated me for failing to meet his expectations, to me, it makes perfect sense he wants to go out and get drunk with his friends who think he's cool. So there is also a very robust depth of humanity, a pathos and a poignancy to the trajectory of Prince Hal's life, as well as there being a very strategic component of a leader who's thinking ahead and everyone's underestimating.
Yeah. Go ahead, Tim.
I was going to take us in a little bit of a different direction, Brandon. So I want you to give your point.
I just, you get the sense that he's not this kind of looking to increase his lands noble and somewhat Machiavellian in the way that his father and Hotspur and some of these and some others are. To your point, Heidi, like if he wasn't the prince, you get the sense that he would be a poet or some great artist or something. Like he has this overflow of seeing the beauty of the world and enjoying it to its fullest that is real for him. It's not, it's like you said, it's not just a show, and he has to be willing to rein that in order to be the prince, to be the king. And it's just like there's this greatness to him that could have been something else if it wasn't bound to this duty, right? It could have been something good even if it wasn't bound to this duty. And so it's because it is bound to this duty, he acts that out in a somewhat destructive way even in that rebellion.
Right.
I was at my local coffee shop the other day and I went to the counter and one of the young women behind the counter said, "Does anyone ever tell you you look like Prince Harry?" Meaning the current Prince Harry, like younger brother of William. And I said, "No, no one has ever said that before because it's not true." I mean, I had a face mask on, like she had no idea what I actually looked like. And she said, "Oh, I think it's because you were standing under that red light and that he has red hair. And so your hair kind of, you know, lit up red." But it got me to thinking about something you said just a second ago, Heidi, that like, given Prince Hal from this play, Prince Hal's kind of response to his father, it makes sense that he would go carouse with Falstaff, you know? And sometimes I don't pay that much attention to the current royal family, but I'm really kind of fascinated by Prince Harry, the younger redhead, and Prince William. They're almost, those two characters are like the two choices that our Prince Hal from this play seems to be facing.
The older brother and the prodigal?
The older brother and the prodigal. He can be, he's like teetering back and forth between each one. And we don't really know which one he's going to choose. And to your point, Heidi, both of them are psychologically understanding. The desire to be the older brother, the approval, the dignity, the power and the responsibilities that come along with that. The younger brother, the prodigal, nursing kind of hurt feelings from neglect, from feeling unembraced. You know, they just both make so much sense. And I think that we're going to see beginning in Act 4. We even are starting to see it now in Act 3, that Hal is kind of on the, he's standing between these two precipices. Precipi could no, it could not precipi? Be precipi. There's no way it could be precipi.
No,
between these two precipices, and he's going to leap in. It looks like he's going to leap into one or the other. But what I hear you saying, Heidi, is that maybe there's a third way for Hal.
He has to find his way.
Yeah.
He has to unify them, right? He refuses to pick a lane. He refuses to become Falstaff's disciple. He refuses to become his father's disciple. He is going to make his own way and he insists on that. But I agree with you, Tim, completely. There's in this play, and I've read it so many times and seen so many performances of it because it's my favorite. And I know this play inside and out, and yet every time I read it, I feel this sense of strain, like this teetering, as you just said, like the precipice is a perfect word. There's this, like, how does a man and a king, like, how does he do that? Like between these two extreme options, and you just know it will be death to him if he picks one over the other.
Yeah.
Most of us have a tendency towards one or the other. Like I actually don't find, and you guys know this, and you both feel differently. I don't like Falstaff. Mm-hmm. I don't find him appealing. I don't find his lifestyle tempting. I find him like the gross fat knight. And I understand he's witty, but I'm not drawn to him. I'm much more likely to be like, do your duty, get yeah. your get get yourself in that throne room and start acting like your father. Mm-hmm. And that would be wrong. That would be death to his soul, right? And so would it be for him to be like Falstaff if he were to abdicate his role and try to make the kingship a common thing that takes place in taverns in the back alleys of London. That also would be death to the soul of the country and the soul of this young man. And so I think most of us, when we watch the play or read the play, we pick a lane.
Yeah.
And Shakespeare is giving us two such extremes and then saying, and yet Prince Hal's got to find his own way. We've got to unify these things. He's got to go to battle. It's actually Hotspur, who's his real enemy, not Falstaff and his father, right? And they're offering two kind of choices of one side of the soul versus the other. They represent the two fragmented parts of his psyche, but it's actually Hotspur who is the enemy here.
Yeah. Yeah.
It would be the worst thing for him would be to become like Hotspur, to have this veneer of success, but inside to be empty and immoderate and full of rage.
Yeah. I'm listening to you, Heidi, and I'm kind of thinking about my younger self, and I'm thinking about my, you know, the students that I've had that kind of like face this dilemma. The dilemma being, are you going to lean into being kind of like the duty-bound older son, the prodigal younger son? And I know for me, the train ran back and forth between those two stations for years and years and years. And I kind of want to say to my younger self and like to students that I've had who have been on that back and forth train, there is a third way. And the third way is to unify. To use your phrasing, duty and desire, to make them part of a unified whole. And I just think that's a harder task because the icons that we see, I don't mean the icons in the religious sense, but the kind of forms that we tend to see tend to be one or the other. It's easy to find a Falstaff. It's easy to find a King Henry. But I do think to be a king as great as Hal, you have to unify. As great as King Henry V will be, there has to be a unity of those two forms.
Right. Right. I think it's the journey of every soul, right? And kingship's the perfect metaphor for it, right? Like to become lord of yourself, to become lord of the realm of your own soul and of this relational world that we live in, is to unify those things. That's how you become the mirror of all Christian humans, right? Like that is like, he's becoming a king just as we are called then to rule ourselves according to the image and likeness of Christ. And that is like, that's Hal's journey in a metaphorical sense throughout these plays. And to do that, he has to do battle. He has to fight enemies. He has to protect boundaries. He has to reject and he has to reject Falstaff, and he has to refuse to be obsequious to his father.
Yeah.
And that then is his journey of unification. I think it's a very metaphorical journey that, to your point, I find myself in it, although I think it's probably maybe more overtly applicable to men, you know? But I also see my own struggles and my own selfhood in this, but I do think there's something very masculine about Prince Hal's journey to manhood.
Yeah.
It's funny that you say that, because I think there's something specific about that for Hal, but you know, I think we talked maybe on the first episode a little bit that not the Hollow Crown, which is these are about, but the Crown, the TV show. In that first season, there's quite a bit of conversation about the crown versus the person for Queen Elizabeth, and I think it's her grandmother in one scene, like talking to her about that. Particularly in her case, it includes technically being the head of the Church of England, and so that first season wrestles with that a lot because she's very young, she's newly married. You know, she's globetrotting as the princess at that point.
And she doesn't have the charisma of her younger sister. That's a big aspect.
Doesn't
of
have
it
the
also,
charisma.
Right?
Huge part of that, right? And she didn't want it, and the younger sister would have wanted it. You find out in seasons later, right? And yeah. And then also she wasn't given the proper education for it either, because she was mm-hmm. a woman. She was given all the pomp and circumstance part, but not the here's how economics work. And so she has to bring in tutors and school herself early in her tenure. Anyway, but it's interesting that doesn't go away when the crown is going to a woman. There's a same element, but clearly in House case, there's some very different expectations for a male heir and a journey toward manhood that can easily relate for those of us, even those of us who don't have to put on an actual crown when our dad dies.
I've got one comment to make, and then I want to ask you guys what you would be looking forward to in Act 4. This act that we're in now, 3, is kind of this hinge act, as the structure of so many Shakespeare's plays are. It's a hinge, and that hinge is Hal is deciding, okay, I'm stepping into kind of the halls of power and I'm stepping out of the tavern halls. But I want to ask you guys in a second what to be looking forward to in Act 4. Just the comment, this is a personal comment. A lot of my work involves speaking to the presidents and CEOs of large humanitarian organizations, large nonprofit, large charities. And I've discovered something, and it just makes me think of why Shakespeare is so obsessed with this question of what should a king look like. I think part of the reason that Shakespeare is so obsessed about it is because, I mean, I think the king is to the nation what the CEO is to a nonprofit. And I'm seeing this pattern show up in my work. And the pattern is every CEO and every president that I talk to talks a great game. With one or two exceptions, they are eloquent. They are passionate about the work. They are just capable verbally. And I think when I started doing this job, I would just be so enamored of these CEOs. And I would think, oh, of course she's in charge. She's brilliant. Of course he's in charge. He's so eloquent. But the deeper I got into the work, the more I actually looked at the organizations kind of that followed the CEO and the president. And sometimes I would be even more impressed, but oftentimes I would be less impressed because there is so much more to being in charge than being eloquent. And I'm just seeing it over and over and over that kind of all of the things that are required to be a really good leader go far beyond your ability with words and your ability to form an argument and your ability to articulate a vision. Like, of course, those are really important things. But when your organization is falling apart underneath you, it doesn't matter how good of a game you talk. And I see that with, I mean, Shakespeare's kings are, and his insurrectionists are so eloquent and they are so verbally dazzling. I mean, Richard II for me, Heidi, Richard II might be the kind of like, is it sine qua non? He is so articulate. Oh, he's just a disaster. As a king, he's just such a poor king. So that's just kind of my little picture into why Shakespeare is so obsessed. Well, of course he's obsessed. His England is in the middle of titanic shifts, and he sees how different England becomes from one generation of ruler to the next, from Elizabeth to James. And he knows enough of his history to kind of see this is what happens when you get a bad king on the throne. This is what happens when you have a great king on the throne. So of course he'd be obsessed with that question. Heidi, what should we look forward to in Act 4?
I mean, everything's leading towards this confrontation, right? Like Prince Hal has now joined the fray, told his father, I won't let you down. I'm going to allow, you know, the big metaphor of the play that we haven't touched on too much in these podcasts. Like I'm going to let the clouds dispel from under me and I will show myself to shine with the light of the sun, right?
And I shall hereafter, my thrice gracious Lord, be more myself. That's not the sun metaphor, but be more myself. Yep. Yeah.
Be more myself, which is more true even than he knows, right?
Yeah,
right? He's, but to inhabit himself means to inhabit his role as king and to inhabit his true existential being, right? And so far he's divided. He's divided between duty and desire, divided between his position as king and his desire to inhabit the full humanity of the taverns and all that. And like this robust personhood, he's saying, I will become myself. And his father, but what in saying that, he does not say, I will become more like you, Dad.
Mm.
He'll say, I'm going to be more myself. Right. So that's just as much a challenge to his father as it is an acquiescence. Right. But he's going to go out and fight. And on a moral level, on an existential level, and on a military level. And so that's what we're looking for. We're looking for this fight. What's it going to happen when we get Prince Hal and Hotspur on stage at the same time?
Yeah.
And where is King Henry and where are and Falstaff going to be when that happens? And that becomes then, you know, the levels of the play.
Brandon.
Yep.
Act four.
I'll be honest with you guys. Act four of this play always just kind of runs right into act five for me. And I think it's partly because it's a rather short act by comparison to some of the others. But also because it's just this, we don't get to the actual battle. Like we just left, like we're going off to battle. But then there's just this kind of tension building across these scenes. Tim, you could probably speak this better than me, but Mike, I would guess that when it comes to putting this on the stage, this is where people start to trim some stuff out when they're trying to save some time.
I think you're right.
But
Brandon, Heidi and I joke around about this. If there's an act that's going to get cut, it's act four.
It's act four.
Like almost every time.
But I think I was so thankful for what Heidi talked about earlier with the explaining that scene one with what's going on with Mortimer and Glendower and Hotspur, because I'm going to want to, I want to pay closer attention to how specifically that those, some of the infighting there is ramping up tension, putting tension into mm-hmm. the play and into what's the battle that's mm-hmm. about to come. And understanding how, like Heidi was talking about that political storyline mirrors the personal storyline. So this time through, I am going to be paying closer attention because I haven't in the past. So I'm hoping I can kind of see a little bit with Heidi's eyes this time around on act four.
Yeah. I just want to remind everyone that you can join the conversation online on Facebook through our sister podcast, Close Read. So if you go to Close Reads Podcast on Facebook, you're going to see a lively discussion, not just about this play, but about the flagship recording that's Close Reads. Right now, we are going into our final section of Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile. And for Patreon subscribers, we are also right in the middle of Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina. So please join us on the Close Reads Discussion Facebook group. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Close Reads Pods and via email by writing to closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. And don't forget about our email newsletter, which you can sign up for at closereads.substack.com. We are so grateful that you joined us for Act 3 of Henry IV, Part 2. Please stay tuned and follow with us as we go through Act 4 and Act 5 of this wonderful history play. Thank you for joining us. And, as always, happy reading.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.